Hi, welcome to another edition of the 19th Hole Golf Show. I'm Ryan Ballingy. It's great to have you here with us. You can get a hold of me on Twitter at Ryan Ballingy, and you can find Golf News Net on pretty much every social media platform at Golf News Net. You can find our work on Yahoo Sports' Devil Ball Golf blog on sports.yahoo.com. Download our over-the-top TV app for Roku TV and hopefully soon for Apple TV. And we are presented by BetDSI.com. If you head over to BetDSI.com, especially this week with the Masters, that is the place to be for all your prop bets, all of your Masters odds, and we use them each and every week in our odds post because they give you a great idea of where the money's moving, how the odds are changing in response in real time, and where you can get your best price. And if you're even in a jurisdiction where you can't bet, BetDSI's odds give you a great sense of what smart people, and sometimes not so smart people, are doing with their money each and every week for golf events. And this time of year is a compulsive gambler's dream. For Masters with so much great stuff going on at Augusta National. So check it out at betdsi.com. Also, just a quick request. If you would go over to podcast.study and fill out a brief survey about you and your listening to this show, we would greatly appreciate it. It helps us keep our show free as we work with Audio Boom and other advertisers to kind of keep down our costs and make sure that we enjoy doing this show and not too much out of our pocket each and every week. All right, so we have already done a Masters podcast. We did a preview with Steve Elkington, the 1995 PGA champion and the proprietor of Secret Golf. He was awesome. Make sure you listen to that show if you have a chance. We have two more Masters preview podcasts coming this week. So we've got one today, and we'll have another one tomorrow. That one tomorrow is with Clark Burrows, who was an outstanding amateur at Ohio State University. He played in the Masters. He now lives in Costa Rica, and we have him on each year around this time and around a couple of other tournaments to talk betting. Just strictly betting, prop bets, who's going to win, how to win your pool, how to pick players, all that important stuff for those of you who get involved in that kind of thing. So that will come out tomorrow. We're going to record that later this afternoon on Monday. This podcast is really Masters-related, but not Masters-related. It's Masters-related because the timing of this book is Tuesday, and the guest is Tom Callahan. And if you don't know who Tom Callahan is, you probably haven't read a lot of great sports books in your life, but Tom was a former senior writer for Time Magazine, was a columnist for the Washington Post. His byline has been everywhere. He has tons of New York Times bestsellers. He has two of them are about Tiger, his father's son, as well In Search of Tiger from 2010 and 2003 respectively. He's a big fan of Western PA guys. He wrote what is arguably the definitive book about Johnny Unitas called Johnny U. And he is out with a new book that's a biography of Arnold Palmer. It's called Arnie, The Life of Arnold Palmer. It comes out on Tuesday. So hopefully by the time you get to download this, it will be available on all of your digital outlets. If you want to get it in person, get a hard copy like we have it, you can do that too. And we spoke with Tom on Monday morning to talk about the book, talk about Mr. Palmer's connection to the Masters, and more about Mr. Palmer in general, because obviously he's a four-time Masters winner. He's incredibly seminal to the history of the Masters, to its relevance, and really more broadly to the profession of being a professional golfer, a touring professional golfer. And so I wanted to talk with Tom about his book, about what he found in writing this biography, which is done in a unique way, doesn't borrow really source material at all from other people's work, including Mr. Palmer's work, which has been ghostwritten over time, including the recent book that came out last year, just after his passing, actually, that he had written about some stories and life lessons, and you'll hear an anecdote from Tom about that book that he found out that was kind of amusing. So we spoke with Tom we had originally intended for about 15 or 20 minutes. You never want to take someone's time too much when you're doing these kinds of things. And we went on for a good 30 minutes, and it was a fascinating conversation. I hope you enjoy it. I hope you enjoy Tom's perspective as a guy who wrote stories, in-depth stories about Palmer dozens of times, but did him at important landmarks as well in his life in 60, 70, and 80 for Golf Digest, and has a better handle on the guy than a lot of people who are in our line of work. So, without further ado, here's Tom Callahan.
Tom, thanks for being on with us. I'm sure that as someone who has spent hours and hours and hours of time with Arnold Palmer over the course of his lifetime, that writing this book was somewhat bittersweet, and the timing, obviously important with the Masters coming up this week, was also interesting as well. Can you walk people through the emotional nature of writing a biography like this, and also kind of your thoughts now as the Masters prepares for the first time without Palmer in the modern era?
Yeah, since 1955. I've been writing this book for 45 years. I first encountered Arnold in the early 70s, and through the years has spent a lot of time with him. For Golf Digest, I went to Latrobe, Pennsylvania 3 times to do long pieces on him. Arnie turned 60, Arnie turned 70, and Arnie turns 80. And through the years, you know, I've been in his company a bunch of times for other things. I was at Bay Hill for several things. Played golf with him once. And so I knew him well. And I was, you know, of course, I hoped he'd be around for my book coming out. I signed a contract to write this book maybe a year and a half ago. And the last I saw him was in June. He called me. He knew I was at Oakmont for the U.S. Open, and he had his adjutant, you know, Doc Giffen, give me a call and say, come over to Latrobe, which I was very touched by that because he was pretty frail. And even though he was only 40 miles away from the tournament, he didn't go. And he didn't see very many people that week. But we sat around, you know, at his desk. In fact, when I sat down, he said, how many times have you sat in that chair? And Doc, who was in the room with us, he answered, he said, you know, 5 or 6. And Arnold said, do you remember the time when I said to you, doesn't your ass hurt from sitting down so much? And let's go play golf. And he and I went and played 3 holes. Well, of course, I'm not likely to forget that. But he was a lovely guy. And it is, bittersweet's a good word because it is, you know, I don't feel sorry for him so much as for us because he had a great life, long life, 87. But I still miss him and the thought of the Masters going on without him. Of course, he'll be a presence there anyway. And he is a presence there. But it is a little, it is certainly bittersweet.
I feel like I've read Arnold Palmer's biography a half dozen times, and it never gets old to me. I mean, it's just fascinating, and there's always another detail that kind of leaks out. But I thought that the approach that you took to writing the structure of the book was fascinating, going by almost seemed like a ranking of the most important years of his life. And I don't know if that's exactly what it was, but could you walk people through the decision to write chapters based on the most important years of his life, kind of 60, 29, 54, and kind of go on in that fashion?
Yeah, I started with 1960 because that's the year he became Palmer. Even though he had won the 58 Masters, but he won the Masters in 60, then he won the U.S. Open, and he all but won the British. You know, he came within one stroke in a fourth round of being live in the Grand Slam after 3 legs. Then he led the PGA after the first round. So that was kind of the year, I thought, to start his story. But then I started over. In the next chapter, I started, you know, with his birth and talked about Latrobe and talked about his boyhood. And then moved on to college. You know, I pretty much stuck to chronology, but I went with my own grist because I trusted my own grist. I didn't look at any of he had written a series of ghosted autobiographies, and I had promised myself to look at them when I was done, and I never did. You know, I was like, I didn't want to be influenced by them, so I didn't go look at them. And even the new book, the last book that came out, I did kind of glance at that. Almost immediately, the first thing I saw was a long passage that I had written like 20 years ago, and it was restructured in the first person. I'm not sure how much Arnold could help with that last project, but because, as I said, he was pretty frail. And his mind was great, you know, and his sense of humor was fantastic. But he couldn't hear a word you said, you know, and he was really, he was really failing. And um, um, so so I kind of went with all with what I with trusted what I knew, and I said right at the beginning, you know, this is a personalized biography, and I hope you don't mind, because it's you know, a lot of things that I saw and a lot of, you know, when Arnold was writing his book, he's only talking, you know, for himself. He didn't go talk to Jack or didn't go talk to Gary Player. I did, you know, I had lots of background in guys who were gone. Tommy Bolt, you know, I spent some time with him, and Snead. I played golf with Snead. I lost $300 to him in a match. You know, he could have beat me playing left-handed, but it was important to him to take the money. You know, we played at the Green Bar once. And I played about as good as I'm a bogey player, but I'm a long bogey player. And, you know, I probably shot the best I could. I might have shot 81 or something, and I lost the front nine, the back nine. You know, he kept trying to get me to press him. I said, shut up, you know. I said, I'm putting this on my expense account anyway. But and I was even with Hogan only one time. I went to see Hogan once in Fort Worth. And but it helped me because, you know, Arnold – Hogan and Arnold had a very bad relationship, you know, and it puzzled Arnold. It hurt his feelings, you know, because Hogan never once called him by his name, never said Arnold, never said Palmer his whole life. It was always fella, hey you. And so, all the time I spent with Palmer kind of came home to roost and helped me. And on balance, of course, you know, I think the reader will be able to see right away I had a great affection for him. But I didn't feel obliged to make him perfect. You know, what he was good enough, you know?
Yeah. And you clearly humanize him because you don't give him the picture, the kind of that we give the people that are our legends and people we love and heroes. We give them sainthood and death. I love that turn of phrase. And we kind of leave out the stuff that makes them human beings, that makes them what they were, that gave them personality, that gave them depth. And you're not afraid to go there with Palmer. And I think that's something I've really appreciated about reading through this, is that I feel like I get a better sense of who Palmer is as a human being with the side stories than, all right, this is what he did in 1960. This is what he did in 1954. This is what he did in buying Bay Hill and buying Latrobe Country Club. I think that's the most fascinating part of learning about a human being, is the stuff that, not that they don't want you to know, but the stuff that they didn't think would ever make it to print.
I guess that's right. But, of course, the main thing, the defining thing about him is how much he liked people. There's no doubt about that. Palmer wasn't a different guy away from the camera. You know, he was the same guy. And he liked people, and he wanted to let them inside the ropes. He wanted them to know him, and he wanted to know them. You know, if he was part of this conversation, he wouldn't be interested in, you know, the Masters, the Open. He'd be interested in who you are, because you'd be a new guy. You know, and who are you? What do you do? Tell me about yourself. You know, and it was completely authentic. You know, his aide and great friend Doc Giffen, he said, people describe me as his handler, but he doesn't need a handler. I'm not his handler. He said the thing about Palmer is he likes people. He says he suffers fools that I wouldn't, you know. And he could get mad at you, you know. He Curtis Strange told me about that one time he had got mad at him. He could get mad at you, but he you know, it was kind of a compliment, you know, that he cared about you. And he got mad at Tiger. You know, we talked about Tiger when he was, like, foaming, seething with how much he thought Tiger let down golf and himself. But his line to me on Tiger that was kind of the best line I've ever heard on Tiger, he said, I think what he lost, Tiger lost his father, he lost himself. He said, my wish for him is not to come back as a player, but to come back as a man. And to me, you can't say it any quicker than that, or better than that.
No, you can't. My sense is that there are several defining relationships in Palmer's life. One was with his father, one was with Winnie, one was with Bud Worsham, even though obviously that was cut off prematurely. What were the defining relationships in your view in Palmer's life, and what did they do to set him up for the life that he enjoyed?
Well, I like the start of your list, absolutely. Gary Player told me, Gary Player is like the MVP of this book. You know, he almost everything he said, we had a couple of long conversations, almost everything he said fit. And I go back a long ways with him, too. I went to South Africa to see him once on his farm. And, you know, for this thing, I went back to him a couple of times. But he told me that in the early years, he and Arnold were playing an exhibition in Cape Town. And Arnold's dad, Deacon, was along. And players like me, he's the hero of all his stories. So he said, you know, I shot 68 and he shot 80 one day, and now we're driving back to the hotel. And Arnold said, I've had a terrible head cold all day. And Deacon said, yeah, if I just got whipped like that, you know, and shot 80, I'd have a terrible head cold too. Don't give me that stuff, you know. He said, you were just lousy. But Gary said, I was like, you know, I couldn't believe it. He said, I think Arnold wanted nothing so much in life as his father's approval, and I don't think he ever completely got it. And I think that's probably true. You know, he was a tough guy, but of course Arnold adored him. You know, he was a tough bird, but all through his parts in the book, you know, he's standing up to Arnold. You know, are you ever gonna grow up and be a man, you know? Arnold told me they almost had a fist fight on his 16th birthday. It actually was a fight, but no blows were landed. Though they slammed into a stove in the kitchen, flattening a stovepipe. But yeah, it's a complicated relationship. But as I say, you know, he adored his father. So it's like Winnie, as you said, he spent 45 wedded years worshiping Winnie, but he loved all women, and more than a few of them loved him back. You know, I mean, that's the thing that it's part of his story. It's not the biggest part of his story, but it's part of his story.
How do you think that Arnold Palmer defined being a professional golfer? Because I feel like, well, obviously he worked with Nicklaus to basically create the PGA Tour as we know it. But he defined this profession, and now other people have influenced that after the fact, but he created it.
Yeah, I think that's so. Before Palmer, golfers looked like sports writers, you know, unmade bets. And he looked like an athlete, you know, prize fighter, middleweight. And he lifted the country club game, put it on those square shoulders, carried it to the people, and made it a sport. You know, and he came along with television. He was, like, delivered with the first sets. You know, he was important. There have been a few better golfers. Not too many. Only a few. But there have been a few better golfers. But nobody is important. And even now, the great thing is near the end of my book, I wanted to just put some voices, an eclectic set of voices, international set of voices, you know, just talking about him. And so I put a lot of messages in bottles and you know, hoping someone would float back in. And everybody called me. Mickelson's tired of talking to me. He's tired of talking to all of us. But I picked up the phone one day. Hey, it's Phil. You know, and he wanted to talk about Palmer. You know, and I sent an email to Tiger, and I'm not his favorite either. And he sent me a long email back on Arnold. You know, he wanted to. He went out of his way, you know. And Bernard Langer, you know, called me to say how he, you know, Palmer, you always had his complete attention, and how he'd send him notes when he'd do something great on the senior tour, and how much it meant to him just to see Arnold's signature at the bottom of the note, you know. And Peter Alice, you know, the great old Brit, you know, who played against Palmer in his first Ryder Cup. You know, Alice said, we tied, he said, we played two years later in the singles. He said, I'm not going to tell you, modesty forbids me from telling you who won, but Arnold lost. you know. but the warmth all these guys express for him, you know. And, you know, and I've talked several times to Rory. I kind of met Rory before he was Rory, before he had won anywhere. And he, you know, he's not a guy full of beautiful lines, but, you know, to me, the best line, one of the best lines in the book, or the prettiest lines in the book, was Rory saying that Arnold handed him his phone number and said, "Here, you know, call me if you ever need anything." And Rory said, "Everything I need, Mr. Palmer, you've already given me." And to me, what a thing for a young guy to be smart enough to say. But it proves. And you have to remember, and I'm sure you know this, Ryan, but to the European players, Seve was their Arnie. You know, they were way too young for him and Seve, but there'd have been a Seve without Arnie, but he wouldn't have been the same Seve. You know, and they all seem to know that. You know, Mickelson told me that at Arnie's invitation, he played his first practice round at Augusta with Palmer, and Palmer said, "Don't walk by the spectators as if they're not there. They're there." You know, and Mickelson never forgot that. Of course, he told everybody he met, including Phil, you know, "Stop scribbling your name. You know, sign your autograph. You know, take some time. These are the people that allow us to play golf for a living." You know, he told Peter Alice, "Only old prospectors put their ex." You know, take a minute to write Peter Alice so I can read it. You know, there's no doubt how profound his influence. You know, he's the guy who really, brought golf into the century. And it's, you know, I consider that in America, the leading foursome, you know, the first foursome of American golf is Palmer, Dwight Eisenhower, Bobby Jones, and Bob Hope. And three of the four had a connection to Augusta. And, you know, Palmer's connection to Augusta was so profound. You know, he said years and years ago, "Why do I want to win the Masters? Why do I want to breathe?" You know, and it was that basic to him. And, of course, he did all his winning in a very small window. You know, he won the 58 Masters, and he won the 64 Masters, and nothing after that. Nicholas won majors for 25 years, player for 20, Arnold for 6. But nobody noticed because they didn't want to notice. And also, he was still in the hunt at U.S. Opens for 10 years after that. Quit winning majors at 34, but he was 44 still trying to win the U.S. Open. But, yeah, there's no doubt that he's really the father of golf.
Do you consider I have in-laws who are from the town over from La Trobe, so I just kind of married the right family for a golf writer. But I feel like there has to be some kind of explanation for the relationship between Arnold Palmer, his family, La Trobe / Western Pennsylvania, and how that all kind of intertwines. In your experience, visiting Palmer, speaking with Palmer hours and hours, what kind of sense do you get of how Western Pennsylvania or La Trobe in particular shaped who Palmer is just as much as his family or his friends?
Yeah, he said, you know, the simplest way to put it, he said, "La Trobe isn't just where I'm from, it's who I am." And he never left. You know, he spent half the year at Bay Hill in Orlando for the weather so he could play golf. But he never left La Trobe and those people, and he came to kind of own the whole town. And he, you know, of course, he talks about it. And he reminds me of Johnny Unitas. I knew Unitas pretty well. He was a Pittsburgh guy. And he was the same kind of guy, fabulous memory and basic things. You know, Unitas was miserable in San Diego at the end, and, you know, not only because he had lost his game, his knees bent both ways, you know, and he did it for the money, but he couldn't wait to get back to where it rained. You know, he said that to me. Where it rains, where it's cold sometimes. You know, and that was Palmer. And Palmer, one of his childhood friends was Fred Rogers, you know, Mr. Rogers'
right.
neighborhood. And Fred Rogers was a year older, but they were buddies, and they made model airplanes together. And lifelong, you know, a lifelong friend. And you mentioned Bud Worsham. Bud Worsham was the younger brother of Lou Worsham, who won a U.S. Open, and who was the club pro at Oakmont, down the road from Latrobe. And Bud and Arnold, they met at a junior tournament and became best friends. And it was Bud who got him to Wake Forest. You know, Arnie probably would have joined the Army. He had been offered half scholarships at Penn State and Pitt, but he didn't know how to swing the other half. You know, he was considering business school. He told me, you know, but he at Wake Forest, Bud went to a dance without him. Couldn't talk Arnold into going, and which was unusual because his favorite things were pretty girls and, you know, bourbon and Coke, you know. But anyway, Worsham and another student were killed driving home from Duke, which is close to Wake Forest in those days, and it broke his heart, of course. And he finished the semester in a fog. And then he joined the Coast Guard, where, you know, he was in the Coast Guard for 3 years. But it was a profound influence on him, you know. And he told me there's some things you never get over, you know. And he loved Bud, and it was a killer, you know. And it's a kind of a large part of his story, you know. And hearing him talk about it, and he would get emotional, and his voice would crack, just like in the last time I was with him, we were talking about Winnie, and his voice started cracking. You know,
yeah.
You know, he was a sentimental guy. He could be a hard guy. He was a tough guy to play with. There were a lot of players told me that there was no mid round compliment from Palmer. You know, he was a killer. Tony Jacklin told me he said the ill will he felt for your ball, you know, came off of squiggly lines. You know, but when it was over, he was the first one to say, well played, you know. But he was a killer competitor, you know. Everybody talks about that. And Tom Watson was 15 the first time he played with him, and that was the first thing he noticed, how much it mattered to him. And it still did, you know. The last day I was with him, Doc told me he had tried to do some chipping. He could barely walk. He could barely move. But he had gone outside to chip a few balls that morning, or try to. And I mentioned it to Arnold, and he said, you know, even if it's just you and that ball out there, it's a contest. He said, even if it's just you and that golf ball, and you're alone and nobody's looking at you, you know. He just loved, as Lee Trevino said, Arnold Palmer loves to slap rubber every day. He said, Nicholas likes to fish and play tennis, you know. He said, Player likes to ranch and raise thoroughbreds. Arnold, he likes to slap rubber.
Do you get the sense that maybe Palmer was so effusive on television that people fell in love with golf because they fell in love with Palmer, because Palmer loved golf? I mean, I think about the way you describe Palmer's love affair with golf, even now as we're speaking, but also in the book. And I think about how other players kind of that have been great may not have loved golf in the same way. Tiger loved competition. I get the sense that was what he did best, was competing, beating somebody, beating something. And his relationship with his father, like you said, Jack, the relationship with his father, he has so many other interests that maybe that's why he didn't kind of connect with the fans in the same way out the gate. But Palmer, from day one, he loved golf. And I think that's why he's still so incredibly beloved.
It's a big part of it. You're exactly right. And Jeff Ogilvie said to me, when you see somebody who loves what he does, whatever it is that he does, it lifts you up somehow. There's, for some reason, it lifts you up when you see that. And, you know, I think you're right. You know, he let people in, and he looked around the gallery, you know, leaning on his club, waiting for his turn to play, checking out the good-looking women in the gallery, you know. When you were in his gallery a second time, you had the sense that he recognized you. and wondered where the hell you'd been. You know, I mean, that's what he was. I've been writing, I have to admit, Ryan, I've been writing this line for 40 years. It's as if God said to Nicholas, you'll have skills like no other, and then whispered to Palmer, but they'll love you more. And I think that's the difference between the two of them. Nicholas pretended, you know, now he sees everything on the golf course, and he's a good guy. But in the earliest days, he only pretended to see people on the course. He was, you know, he would, every 20 minutes, he had trained himself to wink, that horrible synthetic wink of his that makes your teeth hurt, you know. And he would do that just to be a good guy, you know. But he didn't see anybody on the course. At Oakmont, in 62, when they, you know, first started their great rivalry, and Jack beat him in a playoff at the U.S. Open, there was a lot of people in the gallery. It's Palmer country. And a lot of people in the gallery were pissing, miss it, fat guts, you know. Nicholas never heard any of that. You know, his father told him about it, but he never heard any of that, you know, because he was in his own world. And as most golfers, you look at them, you know, Tiger, as you say, you know, they're lost out there. But Palmer couldn't be that way. He had to bring the people in, and he knew exactly when he decided that. It was when he was 13 years old, and he and his dad played in an exhibition with Babe Didrikson Zaharias, and she was full of personality as well as game. And it occurred to Palmer told me, he said, I thought right then, he said, before that I was just competing, but from then on I thought, I'm a show off too. I want the people to you know, be part of it. He said that those folks standing around, they're a part of this. You know, they're in on it. And he said, Babe taught me that. And it's true. You know, he was a guy who went for everything, went for broke, and took everyone with him he could carry.
We talked about the most important people in Palmer's life earlier, and I kind of want to close on, if you kind of sum someone's life up in the Cliff Notes version, is the most important people and the events of fate, the best things and the worst things that happened to somebody that kind of defined who they were. For Palmer, what were the two best and the two worst things that happened to him that defined his life?
Well, probably the best thing was finding Winnie. She was 20. As he said to me, she was only 20 when we got married, and her father hated my ass. You know? But yeah, you know, that I think that was the best thing for him. The best golf thing for him, if you want to, was winning the U.S. Amateur. The public at large kind of doesn't realize how important the U.S. Amateur is to the players. And his awe of Tiger, and he had a lot of awe of Tiger. You know, when he'd be mad at Tiger, but he also had a great respect for his skill. And he told me, you know, when you think of it, three straight U.S. amateurs and on top of three straight USGA juniors, he said 6 years of match play, and he never lost. He said that's his greatest feat. I think that's his greatest feat, and I think he'd say so too. You know, on the debit side of it, you know, he lost four U.S. He was second in four U.S. Opens, lost three of them in playoffs. And the worst one, the one that he could never shake, of course, was the 66 Open he lost to Billy Casper. He's seven ahead with nine holes to go, and he got caught, and then he lost in the playoff the next day. And he probably never spent a day where that didn't cross his mind. You know, that was so bitter. But like Dal Finsterwald, who was another one of his great friends, he told me that. At dinner the next night, the bus boys wanted his autograph, and he treated them so well. You know, he was so nice to him. Dal said, "You'd have thought he won that instead of losing, you know, so bitterly." You know, those were the losses. He had some tough losses, but winning big and losing big was who he was, and nobody cared. Really, when I was a young newspaper guy 100 years ago, people would call in the desks on weekends. What did Palmer do? What did Palmer do? You know, people who didn't follow golf wanted to know what Palmer did. You know, he was important to people to people who hated golf. They loved him, and you know, on the side, as you know, he was an aviator and loved that, and that was an important part of his life. You know, he loved the sky his whole life, and so he flew, 25,000 hours in the left seat, and that was, he was very, very proud of that. He had a good life, but it wasn't always, everything perfect. And even, near the end, Jack and he, once the 10 years difference between them, got smaller and smaller, they came back together. And at the memorial service in La Trobe, Nicholas could barely get through his speech without weeping. As Palmer said to me, he said, we know we love each other now, and we always did.
That's amazing. What an incredible life. And like I said, it's just really cool to see a different perspective on Palmer's life, because you can learn something new each and every time, fit it within all the course of events, and come away with a new, reinvigorated appreciation for Palmer's career and his life. And I came away from your book, Tom, with that. So I want to let people know, Arnie, The Life of Arnold Palmer, is now available on all your favorite book outlets on April 4th. So that's Tuesday for those of you who are listening. We recorded this on Monday. So it's available on Tuesday. You can get it anywhere and everywhere. And Tom Callahan is the man for coming on with us. Thanks for speaking with us. I know we originally talked about coming on to talk for 15 minutes, and it turned into 30, and it was a great 30 minutes. So thank you so much for being on with us.
Well, thanks for having me, Ryan. I appreciate it.
Thanks again to Tom Callahan for being on the show. As I said in the outset, I thought he was absolutely awesome, gave some incredible insight, and as I mentioned, I've probably read Arnold Palmer biographies in some fashion or other. I have a bunch of them on my bookshelf. I've probably read them or read some variant of them 6 times in my life, and each and every time, the biographical component, okay, there are certain key moments you just have to know about Arnold Palmer to kind of get a sense of his life, and we talked about those with Tom, but the little details that you get each and every time from every person's slightly different interaction with him over the years, while it all kind of has the same amazing tone, it is different, and I think that illuminates a character so much more than, as I said, the important biographical kind of high points of their life. It's what's weaved in between that makes something, makes a story compelling, makes someone compelling. And I think, obviously, Arnold Palmer is that kind of person, and Tom Callahan brought that out in his book. So check it out. It is available, again, on Tuesday, April 4th. Again, we will be back tomorrow on Tuesday with another podcast we're recording today with Clark Burrows. We'll talk about your Masters pools, your picks, your betting odds, your prop bets, all of that stuff for you degenerates out there like me who want to lay a little quid on the Masters and hopefully make a little scratch off of it. Again, please give us a 5-star review if you listen to us on iTunes. That review helps us tremendously reach more people. If you want to leave a comment with your 5-star review, we'll be happy to read it on the podcast as well. And make sure to go ahead over to one of your favorite social platforms and follow us. We'll have all kinds of stuff for Masters Week coming out of those quarters as well on our website, golfnewsnet.com. On our video channel on YouTube and Roku TV as well. Also, make sure to check out Masters Week podcasts on Golf News Net Radio on our website as well. We've got some great stuff from Jay Flemma. We've got some great stuff from the Talking Golf Getaways guys. A lot of awesome audio coming your way as you're trying to get to and from work where you're not able to watch the Masters if you're at work. Make sure to tune in while you have a chance before you get to really enjoy the Masters over the course of the weekend. Again, I'm Ryan Ballengee saying thanks for listening, and we'll talk to you tomorrow on the next edition of the 19th Hole Golf Show. Enjoy Masters Week, everybody.